Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode 333. First, out of the gate, I just want to say huge thanks to everybody out there who supports our program. If you haven't done so yet, please head on over to WCYpodcast.com, do a little bit of exploring, and check out the ways you can support this program, either through direct donations, buying a lapel pin, or using one of our affiliates, whether that's Onnit, or Bankers Best, or Thrive, or whatever. It all goes right back into the production of this show. This week on the program, I do have an amazing conversation we had with Frater O and special guest, worshipful brother, Robert Jackson. Robert Jackson, I met him up at MasonicCon last year, 2017, up at Ezekiel Bates. What an incredible gentleman, huge intellect, very awesome guy. He's actually on the program this week. We talked last week, and before our conversation, he actually gave me a virtual tour of his lodge, which was just incredible. So huge thanks goes out to Rob Jackson for that. And if his name sounds familiar, it's because he's actually submitted a few pieces for the Midnight Freemasons, and he's actually a great candidate to become a regular on the blog. So look for that in the future, but for now, let's get right into this week's conversation, again, that we had with Frater O and Brother Robert E. Jackson. We talked about the number 7, and how it relates to Freemasonry, how it relates to kind of the ideas of ancient cultures, and some of the hidden symbolism behind it. So, give a listen. Alright guys, we're back this week and I've got two guests on the program. It's going to be an amazing episode, a really great / interview conversation. I've got Frater O on the program. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me as always. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've also got Rob Jackson on the program. If he sounds familiar, it's because we've had him on the Midnight Freemasons before. His full name, Robert Edward Jackson, he's a past and presiding master of Montgomery Lodge located in Milford, Massachusetts. Welcome on the program.
Thanks, RJ. It really is an honor.
Man, yeah. I loved having the time to talk with you when we were up at MasonicCon. It's coming up again. I hope we cross paths again up there and hang out.
Definitely.
But it definitely was amazing to hang out with you both and have some really great conversation. This week on the program, everybody, we are going to talk a little bit about the number 7, how it relates to certain things, maybe the Pleiades. We're going to kind of just wax on it for a little while because we've talked about symbology in numbers and in certain, I guess, how a number or how an idea is portrayed in a certain like niche in Masonry. But in this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about a lot of the different things that the number 7 alludes to. So I hope you guys put on your thinking caps. If you guys have any great insights after the episode, feel free to shoot us some emails and keep the conversation going on Facebook. So first and foremost, I'll toss it over to Frater O on some initial kickoff comments.
There's some interesting symbolism. When you go through the degrees, you can always kind of find a lot of, we always say, shocking correlations, right? It's consistent over and over and over. And it blows your mind. When you're able to widen that keyhole that you're looking through of your consciousness, the more you'll be able to see consistently over and over and over again. So, you know, digressing back to the number 7, and as we always like to talk about here, the allegory of, you know, King Solomon's temple being the human body, you know, our body essentially has 7 different parts, right? The head, the chest, the abdomen, 2 legs, and 2 arms. As well as you have like 7 different internal organs, like the, you know, the stomach, the liver, the heart, the lungs, the spleen, to kidney. And there's 7 different endocrine glands as well. And we've touched many times on the 7 different chakras, or the microcosm or the macrocosm of the human body. Most universes have usually 7 planets that orbit around the sun as well. This is the kind of kicking off there. I mean, ancient also in the Bible, which is, you know, growing up Catholic or Christian, you have like 7 seals, you know, 7 years of repentance. You guys mentioned something earlier, which I would think would be a perfect segue for you, Robert, or you, Robert.
It might get confusing.
So I'll say RJ for you, Robert Johnson, and then
Robert Jackson.
Robert Jackson. I'll just say Robert Jackson. If you guys want to pick up and kind of get into, we were talking in the green room earlier, which was really fascinating. Personally, I've never heard of this, but the seven churches of Asia.
Yeah, so it was pretty interesting. We were doing a little bit of digging on the number seven just before the program, and Rob Jackson actually came across something that was interesting as it relates to the Pleiades. Rob, I don't know if you have that handy, if you would read that again.
So from Mackey's Encyclopedia Volume 2, talks about the seven stars. It doesn't mention the Pleiades, but it talks about the seven stars and talks about the tracing board of the 17th degree, or Night of the East and West, and is a representation of a man clothed in a white robe with a golden girdle around his waist, his right hand extended and surrounded with seven stars. The 17th is an apocalyptic degree, and this symbol is taken from the passage in Revelation, I-16, and he had in his right hand seven stars. It is a symbol of the seven churches of Asia.
Right, and so at that point, I'm pretty well read with scriptural texts, but I don't, and I hadn't heard of the seven churches of Asia, and we just looked it up very quickly, and it was interesting to note that the seven churches of they're also called the seven churches of Revelation, or the seven churches of the Apocalypse, and it does come out of the book of Revelation, and it refers to seven early Christian, not churches per se, but groups or villages where Christians were. So Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea, Patmos. And so it was kind of interesting just to hear that. And what it alludes to is Jesus instructs his servant, John of Patmos, through an angelic intermediary to write on a scroll what you see and send it to the seven churches. And that's in quotes. And they're referring to those seven places. And there are seven messages, and each one of these messages is personalized to that church, and each one has something interesting to say on it. One, just a cursory search on Wikipedia, pulls up an interesting quote where within the seven messages, it says something to the effect of, "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches," which is kind of interesting. I was just immediately struck with kind of the idea that we always hear in many theological circles, which is, "Let he who hath ears hear, let he who hath eyes to see, see," that kind of thing. And the way I have always thought about that is, there's a message out there that many people who aren't that deep into symbology don't necessarily have the eyes and ears to hear and to see these things. They are, for all intents and purposes, blind to these additional symbols and the concepts that they represent. It does seem like throughout all histories, we have a good pack of Masonic writers, guys like A.E. Waite, guys like Mackey. And Mackey's probably on the more mainstream side of things, but you've also got guys like George L. Plummer and guys like Wilmshurst, who are all so adamant about the idea that Masonry is in a horrible state because nobody practices Masonry. They only practice the ritual. They have no idea what we're doing. They just do it to do it. And so this kind of idea, I'm just curious, you know, I'm pulling the thread a little bit on this one. I said we would just kind of wax about this for a few, but the idea that maybe the seven churches is like a further allusion to some sort of scriptural reading or doctrine that says maybe we need to train people to look deeper, or maybe guys just need to be ready to look deeper. I don't know. It's just interesting to me, though.
One thing, the seven sisters, the stars, I have not been incredibly observant to them, right? I have not seen them previous to, you know, some of the recent discussions. And, you know, much like now you travel around and you can, you know, see square and compasses and almost everything, but there's so much architecture and art where those seven stars, it's not that, you know, you're seeing it because your mind wants to see it. It's obvious that those seven stars are there. And the presence of the seven sisters and those stories transcends among multiple cultures, from the Greek and the Pleiades to Native American lore, with the Devil's Tower in Wyoming, which there's a story where seven sisters were going to the waterside in the river, And they found they encountered a bear, and when the bear started chasing them, one of the sisters knelt and prayed for help. And when she did that, the ground lifted up and met up with the heavens. And the bear was unable to climb the tower, Devil's Tower. And that's it looks like there's scratch marks on the side. And the view is, the story is that those seven sisters ended up rising into the sky, and they stayed into the sky forevermore. And I mean, even for agriculture, identifying the time to plant to the time to harvest based on where the Pleiades is within the sky, at least in the Northern Hemisphere.
What's totally interesting about that is the more we research into ancient man, the more we research into time before recorded history, Manly P. Hall in a lecture said something along the lines, I want to say this was probably in the late 60s, maybe the early 70s. Hall would go around and he would just deliver speeches and just talk for hours, right? No script, or no notes, rather. And one of the things he talked about was you had guys like, I know we're going to have some conspiracy theorist guys, ears perk up here, but ufologists and this kind of thing. But when Chariots of the Gods came out, Eric von Daniken proposed some interesting questions. You know, are ancient man, were they visited by not angels or anything, but were they visited by extraterrestrials? This kind of idea. But what's interesting about that was around that time, Hall kind of addressed this question, and he said something to the effect of, perhaps it's not so much aliens visiting man, but what if the remnant of what we find is what's left of a high society that destroyed themselves? And, you know, we're the latest iteration of whatever. We're building up to where we were before. And I find that interesting because when we look at a lot of these things, you know, these ancient myths about these people that came to Earth, or these teachers, people like Thoth, Quetzalcoatl, Viracocha, Huan Di, or in Assyria, you have the seven sages, the Apkallu. You had Enoch's angels, these watchers who taught the seven liberal arts and sciences to him, and angelic script. And it's just wild because almost all of our worldwide cultures have this affinity toward the seven sisters. You've got Dogon tribes who talk about the Pleiades, and they talk about the dog star Sirius, which they've known had a binary star system, and we only recently found this out. It's interesting to see, like, what did ancient man know? And the more we research on this stuff, they're so heavy into astronomy and astrology. Back then, it was mixed. It was one subject. Today, it's, you know, heavily, it's almost three subjects, really. I mean, if you really want to dig into it. But the whole idea of astronomical precession and where these stars, like, came up in the morning sky and where they went away, it's interesting to see how our ancient man dealt with explaining away these kind of things. Like I said, it's an overarching archetype for so many things. I know, Frodero, you studied chakras and things extensively. Maybe you can give us a little bit of a breakdown on the chakras and the number seven.
Yeah, I mean, seven can be, you know, on so many levels. We've covered ancient mythology. We've covered the solar kind of, or the universal kind of ideology. But to touch on, you know, the parts of the body, we talked about different areas of the body earlier, but going right back to the chakra, you have these seven chakras in ancient societies. They were referred to, the Sanskrit translation of chakra means wheel. And the ancient Eastern philosophical schools of thought believed that these wheels were endocrine glands, and they emitted frequencies and energies. And these were seals and steps on the path to enlightenment, that these on this flow of energy to higher states of consciousness that you had to let go and release of. And each gland was an emotional part of your actual mind and subconscious. And to be able to move forward on these seven rungs of ladder or chakras, or we did a great episode fairly recently on the Masonic Roundtable on Jacob's Ladder. And if you look at Jacob's Ladder being the spinal column, you'd have these seven gates, again, with chakras. Start with originally, you know, the root chakra, which is focused on the base of the spine, or kind of like the pelvic floor. And the next step up is you have like the sacral chakra, which is sacral area, and like lower areas, more like the reproductive system of endocrine glands that it correlates to. The next step up is you have the solar plexus chakra. Again, the solar part of the body, you know, where the middle of the abdominal area. The step up from that is what you have is the heart chakra. The next step up from that is the throat chakra, which correlates to the thyroid. And then, you know, when you get past the throat chakra, you get to the brow, third eye chakra, which is between the eyebrows, which is correlated to the pineal gland and many different systems, or the eye of Ra. And then, of course, you have the one above, which is the crown chakra, which is like the final step. And then in many different systems, they've always had, like, there's seven seals. And there's a, you know, I think we covered this really early on when I first started coming back on about 2 years ago. The Last Airbender did an amazing episode on chakras, and it used tools in a cartoon fashion to show on how to release energy and steps. I'm sure we can put that in the show notes as well. But you guys touched on some really important areas on space.
You have seven liberal arts and sciences, right? You've divided into four and three, right? One of the diagrams Fratero has shown me before, I believe it was talking about the seven chakras divided into four and three. So I keep thinking, right, and four and three obviously add up to seven. That's, but then what is one of the other tools that we teach, or one of the emblems that we use, where three and four are two out of the three key numbers, right? And that's Pythagorean's theorem, right? It's a 3-4-5 triangle. And essentially that hypotenuse is the combination of the three and the four, which gives you seven. Although the direct line is not quite seven, it's quicker to get there. I don't know if that makes sense or if that's just too far out.
Math is like a good fundamental behind all of it. It's important too when you study math and geometry and you study vibration and sound or the human body or the cosmos, you'll find, again, this word we love to use in the show, shocking correlations. You know, but again, the whole idea of as above and so below, RJ, the universal kind of aspects of above, something you've studied.
Yep. So I'm not the expert by any means in terms of planetary bodies. That's Mike Hambrecht. He is the astute astronomer, actually. But something that I have looked into, I study one of the things that is going to be in the book we're releasing is a real breakdown of Masonic and occult symbolisms as it relates to the body of man. And so much of it is not necessarily archetypal, in that to say something like Thoth is Hermes Trismegistus or is Hiram or is whoever. Sometimes one symbol is a spider web unto itself that has all these other things that are attached to it. They're attributes of things. And one of the interesting ones is, so I'm studying tarot at the moment through my Boda studies, and you learn about archetypes and qualities and these kind of things, and it's interesting. But astrology can play into that. And when you talk about as above, in the classical sense of what we would consider before recorded history, in the time before time, there were seven main planets. So they considered the Sun, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, Saturn, and the Moon. The Moon was the seventh. It wasn't attributed to the seventh number. It's just encompassing the seven there. So the Sun was attribute was gold, which is interesting because as we look at gold, gold is literally a substance that is finite in the universe, and that the only time you get gold is because of a supernova explosion. Literally, gold is blood of the Sun. So it's interesting that ancient man put these things together. Maybe it's just a coincidence. The Sun is yellow and they attribute it to gold, whatever, I don't know. Moon with silver, Mars with iron. Of course, what I've said so far, right, we have yellow, gray, and a red, so they kind of do match up to their metals. Mercury was interesting. That's the quicksilver. Jupiter was tin. Venus is copper. Saturn is lead. And of course, they also allude to the days of the week. So the Sun is also Sunday. The Moon is Monday. Mars is Tuesday. Mercury is Wednesday. Jupiter Thursday. Venus Friday. Saturn is Saturday. And it's interesting. So you also can look at the old English Norse traditions. So Sun's Day, Moon's Day, Dies Martis, Woden's Day, Jupiter Thursday, Thor's Day, Venus is Freya's Day, and Saturn is Saturn's Day. Saturn alludes to Satan, or kind of the humanistic side of things. It's just wild to me how the number seven, like, is so interwoven into culture and into symbology that we really take it for granted unless we dive in and pick apart, like, oh, wow, days of the week, the planets, common alchemical metals. This is bizarre. You had Roman gods attributed to the days. Sunday is Sol, so Sol Invictus. Luna, Mars, Mercurius. Thursday is Jove, Venus, and Saturnus. And these names for these celestial bodies slash gods are in several different languages too, which tells you that this language of astronomy was, it spanned from Anglo-Saxon or the Saxon lands, Rome, in Latin places, French, Italian, Spanish. It just spans everything.
One thing I was reading recently is the Ursa Major, right? Big Dipper as a kid is seven stars. And if I remember right, that is the constellation where if you follow or if you draw its position in the sky at the four pinnacle points, right, the solstices and the equinoxes, you get an interesting symbol from there as well, just from Ursa Major. Also, out of all the numbers, 1 through 10, 7 is the only one that does not divide into 360 evenly.
Very interesting. See, I'm like, I'm kind of a math junkie, so when people give me, like, the fun math problems or whatever, like the magic math, you know, I'm always into that. So I'm going to have to dive into that a little bit. It's always interesting to see, you know, what these numbers do when you place them in different systems, right? Like, whether that's gematria or, you know, whatever have you. One of the things I think I want to do is define. You mentioned equinoxes and the solstices. A lot of folks don't necessarily know exactly the definition of what a solstice is versus what an equinox is.
Essentially, the equinoxes happen because of the Earth being a little off-center, right? A little off-kilter. But that's what really helps us. That's what really gives us the seasons. The solstices are the extreme periods, but the equinoxes are the ones where we kind of rotate that axis. So essentially, if the Earth wasn't a little off kilter, we wouldn't get the four seasons that we get. And if humans weren't a little off kilter, you probably wouldn't have a lot of the knowledge and discussions that we have.
That's a good point. I mean, do you ever look at the actual compasses? They're actually at 23.5
degrees. 23.5
degrees. Or the 25.3 or 23.5? It's actually the way the equinoxes, the actual hemispheres,
really?
Changes. Don't hold me to the exact numbers, but in stellar theology, Masonic symbology, Brown gets into it. The compasses, majority of the time, are always at 23.5 degrees, and it shows the correlation between the pole movements and how it actually.
Oh, that's weird.
So for anybody listening who paying attention to some of these terms, I'm just going to give you two brief paragraphs from the book that we're putting together explaining the equinox and explaining the solstice. So for anybody who doesn't know, to understand that the solstice is an event which happens twice a year when the sun is either farthest from or closer to the equatorial plane, which will cause either shorter or longer days. The solstices happen in the winter and in the summer, and both last a number of days. The solstices, it should be noted, involve intense calculations and are not easy by any means. The solstices usually hit on or around the 21st of June for the summer and the 21st of December for the winter. In essence, it marks the degeneration and regeneration of life, the seasons, and much more. It's the basis of countless myths and legends, and also the basis of the Eleusinian Mysteries, which was an adaptation of Egyptian ritual, which was largely the progenitor to the symbolic Masonic ritual written for the third degree sometime within the early to mid 18th century. The equinox is simpler, but perhaps more fascinating. It is the time when the sun, or Sol, is closest to the equator, causing equality in night and day. It speaks to the equilibrium of light and dark, chaos and order. It is observed also twice a year, but rather than winter and summer, it's in the autumn and the spring. The equinox does not take place over days, rather it takes place at a specific moment. Although easier to calculate, it is still advanced in thinking and requires the most adept individuals to calculate and also adapt mythology to these teachings. So the equinox happens at about March 23rd in the spring and about September 20th for the autumnal.
The equinoxes are amazing, and if you look at it at the first degree, or if you look at the allegory of the St. John. St. John the Baptist and St. John the Evangelist are pretty unique. And if you look at it at the same time, when we have these massive feasts in most states, and the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts, they have a big banquet around the Feast of St. John in December, and it's always around a very unique day as well. So there's, again, there's a lot of interesting festivities. I know the Evangelists pertaining to December, the Baptists mainly pertaining to June. But again, digressing back to seven, interesting, there's seven tones the actual voice can create. And on the harmonic scale, there's actually seven, which is a very unique sound. But you sound and light, there's very, again, unique correlations. And if you start looking at light, and you shoot a light through a prism, come out with seven colors.
Seven colors of the rainbow.
Roy G. Biv? Laugh all you want. That seriously saved my hiney in grade school.
So it's weird. Like, I can't help but think of, right, in the 80s, there was this band, Stryper, right? And they were like the Christian, quote-unquote, heavy metal band. And they kept talking about, like, 777 being the great number of God, to counteract 666, reportedly the number of the beast, right? My mind keeps going there. But there's also stories about the seventh son of the seventh son, an album title which got me into a lot of stuff, good stuff, and all about the seventh son of the seventh son was supposed to have the gift of clairvoyance, which is always really a double-edged sword when you start looking at the ability to see the future, especially your own future.
You brought up an interesting thing about 777, right? That's, I mean, how many, you go into a casino, right? I mean, it's 777. You consistently hear the lucky number seven all the time. A lot of artists and musicians will paint that in there too. Or you'll find it in movies. If you read any of Robert Sullivan's work, he's written Cinema Symbolism. He talks about the correlation of the number seven consistently in so many movies. One in particular that's just ringing and striking a chord in our conversations is the famous movie The Mummy, and on how they have the Egyptian Book of the Dead and there's seven seals that they release, and then that's when, you know, the mummy comes back to life. Again, you can find it in every place you look. It's consistent.
There's seven deadly sins.
There is. There is seven deadly sins, which, again, that's Christianity's take on seven chakras. Seven chakras is more of an Eastern take, but you can find that consistently over and over and over. It's just more dogma.
It's kind of cool, like you talked about this band who said 777 was like the number of God or whatever. And so, just out of curiosity, I said, well, what's the match in Jewish gematria to 777? So there's several things that match to 777, which is like order out of chaos, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now, of course, these are literally just randomized things that go together that would equal 777. So, I mean, you'll get some things in there like
a very large airplane,
science, this, the action. But some of the cool ones, I mean, are just neat, and conspiracy theorists would have a field day with this, I'm sure. Things like God of a Thousand Names, King Father Saturn, the Reptilian Demiurge. Oh, no. Look out, David Icke. The Golden Ratio Measure. Pineal Ajna, the hidden key code of God. Like, it's pretty interesting. I mean, you can attribute it to whatever. Simple gematria, I don't think anything adds up to 777, or in the English for that matter. But it was interesting nonetheless, and I'm sure the listeners are tired of my tangent, but you're listening anyway, so I hope you're enjoying, everybody.
You know, if you still get into, like, Christianity, there were seven kings, and, you know, there were seven angels with trumpets. There's seven spirits or angels with the throne before God. So, like, Michael, Gabriel, Lamal, Raphael, Zachariotl, Ariel, and Orphelio? I'm bad with pronunciation, so don't, again, hold me to it. Seven vices, which you talked about, the seven deadly sins, the seven vitals of wrath to be poured out before the apocalypse. The seven dips in Jordan, which cleanse Jesus from leprosy. It's consistent. I mean, you can keep finding... The story of Genesis is an interesting read. You find some really nice numbers of seven. Again, consistent. It's interesting, too, in the Bible, you know, King Solomon's temple took 7 years to build. It was dedicated on the seventh month.
Really have to wonder, right, when I hear about the prominence of things like this, the number seven in so many different religions and so many different stories, good and bad, right? how many of it actually traces back to those seven stars in the sky?
Well, I don't know, man. So that's kind of interesting, right? Like, if we reference the idea of seventh heaven, right? Like, so we talk about that in terms of Euphoria, not the show, which is terrible. there's the seven heavens, which is in Islam and Judaism, and is mentioned in apocryphal texts and in Hinduism. In Mesopotamian religion, there was an idea that had seven heavens that were originated from the ancient Mesopotamia, a symbolic concept. It's called, and in the Sumerian language, it says the words for heaven or sky and earth are An and Ki. So the Sumerian incantations of the late millennium during before the Christian era make references to seven heavens and seven earths, which is kind of interesting, right? If you look at apocryphal texts or Gnostic texts in Christianity, there's a heavy significance in terms of some of the things Jesus tells. For instance, in the Gospel of Judas Iscariot, Jesus tells Judas some really interesting things about multiples of abundances, as he's referring to them, you know, in the heavens. We've also got in Islam, there's seven heavens, and I don't know how to pronounce them, so I'm not going to try, but if you look up in the Quran, the seven heavens, there's actually a really interesting diagram that they show also, which, when you think about these levels, we talk about things like maybe the Kabbalah and these filters and how, you know, God has to come through these different levels. And we talk about the different levels of existence and light penetration. It's just fascinating to see how these things kind of overlay. And it must take some sort of genius to maybe put all these things together and like overlay them and come out sane.
Lead it to the seven-layer cake.
No, you can take
the seven-layer cake. What's in a seven-layer cake, Rob? I don't even know.
Please enlighten us.
But it's vegan.
Ooh, which is pretty clutch. Pretty clutch.
Do you have a seven-layer bean dip before?
Seven-layer taco dips? Guys, I'm getting hungry. This is bad. As a tangent, I did my second-to-last official visit last night as a district deputy, and I said to somebody, my greatest accomplishment being a DDGM was losing 30 pounds while being a Freemason. it garnered some laughs, you know, but I was like halfway serious. So now I'm getting hungry because we're talking about seven-layer cakes and dips.
Taco Bell, wasn't that a seven-layer burrito?
Ooh, son of a gun. Rob, you're killing me with this.
I lived on those things in college.
I'm pretty sure we all lived on, whether it was the seven fast food restaurants, or we could just go on and on forever. But I did want to jump back on the topic really quick, because there is some things in Jain cosmology that talk about seven-level underworlds, which there is seven layers of hell there in what they call Naraka, and they're further divided into 8,400,000 other hellish locations.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, so if you're particularly a bad boy, look out. They got you covered for the next however many years.
We're talking about religions. You know, theosophy, too, is a big thing. When you kind of get into the esoteric circles, and I think it was Alice Bailey or Madame Blavatsky, or she said there was seven races, each with seven sub-races, which was pretty fascinating, and how Atlantis created, you know, seven cultures and et cetera, and it was spread out. She believed that there was, like, right here, so there was five races and two yet to be discovered that were on the North and South Pole. They were the mystic fire people, right?
This is Blavatsky. Yeah. She's a trip. I think Blavatsky is so interesting, right, because we've got all of these Masonic writers over the years, and there were so many, like, great Masonic writers that really took us on some pretty wild trips, right? Like, one of my favorite books right now is, I'm for the first time, I'm going through it, reading it as a Mason and understanding more of it. And I don't know, so not that I didn't pay attention 10 years ago or whatever, but just with new eyes, right? And I'm reading Wilmshurst's Meaning of Masonry, and I'm probably about a third of the way through it, and I can't quite feel like, I'm not sure if he's an advocate for Christianity, or if he takes kind of the Rosicrucian idea that Plumer takes, which is that Jesus is like the penultimate cognitive man in terms of like esoteric knowledge. But within Wilmshurst, like guys like Wilmshurst, who are these titans of Masonic symbolism and writing that, you know, of course, don't write tomes like Morals and Dogma. They reference in their materials, in their Masonic works, they reference people, not particularly in The Meaning of Masonry, but they'll reference people like Blavatsky just out of the blue, and they talk about the great work she's done. In fact, there's another good book, if you're into that kind of stuff, is it's called Ghostland, and I want to say it's by, the name is Brighton, so Ghostland by Brighton. So you can get a Kessinger reprint on that if you guys find one. Probably like $30, but it's a paperback, and I don't know, about an inch thick. I think I talked about it on the show a few weeks back, but ultimately kind of a cool book, too. Sorry, I derailed you a little bit.
No, you picked up exactly where it needed to be picked up. Covered a lot. We should definitely give some credit to John Anthony West. He recently passed with his...
Oh, yeah. Give some credit to John Anthony West. And John Anthony West was one of these guys who was a real advocate for the search for what these symbols really mean, and the civilizations that regarded these things so highly. Guys like John Anthony West, of course, you know, I think just recently we had posts by Graham Hancock where he talked a little bit about his friend, John Anthony West. Guys like Charles Hapgood, and there's some guys who are really into these numbers and these symbols that aren't even Masons, which should concern Masons, to be frank, in terms of we've got so many people out there who will tell us that these things are things maybe we shouldn't focus on because they're not grounded in reality. We're looking for significance where there might not be any, right? There's a technical term for that, like you see what you're looking for. But that, while that might be true, I'm not sure if that's totally true when we like take a step back and we look at all of these significant scholars who believe there's something there. Guys like John Anthony West, like Dr. Bruce Fisher, you know, these titans.
It is, and he wrote a really good book, and if you want to explore more, it's called Serpent in the Sky, and it's funny, he has a chapter in it that gets into the correlation between at certain times that the Pleiades perfectly align with the actual Giza Plateau and the two sister pyramids. His work and what he's done in Egypt over the past 70 years has just rewritten past. So magnificent person. He did a series too, highly recommended for any esoteric Mason. It's called Magical Egypt.
Oh,
it just came
out. So Egypt. Good.
Amazing. Yeah. Blue, I mean, it's deep. It's all based on R.A., who's a brother Swaller, D. Lubrick's work, The Temple of Man and The Temple in Man. And it's phenomenal. It's deep. Excuse my language.
So didn't the guy who did Temple of Man, he wrote the book that was based on the Egyptian temple, right?
Yeah, the Luxor Temple of Man.
Yeah, I think we may have touched on that in a previous episode, but regardless, fascinating topic. And I think anybody who's listening to the program, do yourself a favor, Google that. It's fascinating what you'll find there. One of the other things I was going to mention, you know, you hop on Wikipedia and, you know, all your links are just highlighted. So I don't know if you guys have ever done this where you start reading one thing and then you click the link to, like, see what this thing is. And then 20 minutes later, you're 100 articles away from where you started.
50 different tabs.
I believe that's called the rat hole.
Okay, sure. Yep. That's what I get into. And one of the things that I ran into was Seven Logos, which it says, according to Ayyavazi mythology, there are seven Logos, which is seven upper worlds. So again, another, and this is Sanskrit, so another allusion to seven iterations of heaven. It's bizarre.
You know, final thoughts for me. Another good book we kind of just briefly touched on is Stellar Theology and Masonic Astronomy by Brown. Free PDF you can find online. It's past its copyright. It's like in the middle of the book. I highly recommend just looking up, you know, the Pleiades, and you'll find some amazing, amazing articles and legends and emblems and the significance. I'm not going to go into detail, but definitely check it out. Rob or RJ?
So as usual, I end up walking away from these episodes thinking I've learned like the hare and the lion's mane, right? And I've now been introduced to all of these other hares to go chase after and investigate. And I think, RJ, what you're saying before, it has some merit where you might be finding something because you want to find something. But the commonality of separate cultures, separated cultures that have never commingled, and them all having similar stories and similar meanings behind the number seven or the Pleiades. It leads me to believe that there has to be something more there.
I think there's probably something to be said. You know, whenever we get together and we talk and we kind of have a mastermind session, and the listeners out there, I hope you guys feel like you're part of this mastermind session, in that it touches your mind on a level where you're able to take some notes maybe while you're doing this, or maybe you're putting a note in your phone, like, because you're driving and you're like, hey, Siri, remind me to look up XYZ. Right? Like, I do this all the time, and I kind of bookmark places in the podcasts or whatever that I'm listening to. So I hope you guys get some good value out of this. And I know we talk on esoterics and symbology sometimes, and we'll take a Masonic topic and we will utterly expand it into where, you know, its fingers touch literally hundreds of other things. And so I hope you guys enjoy that. One of the books that is probably my favorite Masonic book, or written by a Mason, is Milton Alberto Pottinger. I never say his middle name, but Milton A. Pottinger. His book on symbolism, again, it's one of these Rocky and Bullwinkle titles. It's Symbolism, or A Treatise on the Soul of Things, How the Natural World is But a Symbol of the Real World, the Modern Church with its Spire and Cross, and the Bible Account of Noah's Ark, Symbols of the Phallic Religion. It's also a book about the pack of playing cards of the Book of 52, an ancient Masonic Bible, each card a symbol of universal law, the United States Masonic nation whose duty and history are read in these ancient sacred symbols. Like, that's all part of the title of this book. It's on archive.org. Type in the number 7, because about a third of this book is about the first tarot deck. And if you don't know, the first tarot deck ever created is literally the deck of cards that you all play with. There are symbols on every card that are the same no matter what deck you buy. If it's a themed deck, 99% of the time, the same things are shown. And I'm not sure if there's, like, maybe a playing card law that you have to have these symbols on every card, but they're there. And it goes from the direction that the face cards are looking and everything else. But if you pull up the PDF and you type in the word 7, not just the number, but type the word 7 out, there are several places throughout the book that reveal key instances where the number 7 has huge, shocking correlations. It has amazing significance in what you're reading. They talk about 7 years in the 12 signs of the zodiac. There is a bit about seven star. One of the queens in the deck is sometimes topped in the tarot deck, is topped with a crown of 7 stars. So very similar to what Rob talked about in the beginning of the program. It talks about the 7 seals of the Book of Revelation, which have been broken, and it's very interesting stuff. And, you know, you can pick any number. Most numbers, specifically these symbolic numbers, things like 357912 and so on and so on, or whether those are Gematria numbers or whether they are Fibonacci sequence numbers, there's a mystical side to that. And I think, you know, you can really dive in and pull whatever you want out of those whenever you want to. This week we talked about 7. It's not that it's better or, you know, more wild or crazy than any other number. It just happened to be the one that we agreed to talk about. I hope you guys all enjoyed, and we'll have as much as we can fit into the show notes that we remember to throw in there. And special thanks to Frodero for coming back on the show. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. And one last thing, too.
Yeah.
Time you're in lodge, just count how many officers there are.
Oh, boom. There you go. One more taking it.
Yeah, but it's always a pleasure to be among great company and good friends and be able to nerd out in these discussions.
Yeah, I feel the same way. You know, whenever I talk to you guys, like Rob says, you always learn more than you talk. So, and if you're not learning with the people you're hanging around with, you're hanging around the wrong crowd. So hopefully you guys are all in the right rooms and hanging around the right people. Rob Jackson, dude. The fact that we've never had you on the show before kind of is mind-blowing to me, but I got to have you on more often. This was really great, and can't wait for your next articles to come out on Midnight Freemasons, so I hope you decide to write a little bit more. Thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thank you. It is an honor. I really appreciate it. I've been listening to you for a long time, and to be a part of the show and be able to feel like I could contribute something is pretty amazing. Hope I did bore everybody, and I hope it was good contributions.
Oh, I'm sure you didn't bore anybody. This show hopefully keeps most on their feet. If not, I've never heard anybody say they turned it on and an episode was so crazy they just turned it off. Like, so, I mean, that's probably good, right? I've had some brothers say it was over my head, but I listen anyway. And that's really cool that we have listeners who, quote-unquote, will put up with some of our wilder episodes. Thanks so much, everybody, for tuning in this week. All right, I hope you enjoyed that conversation that we had with Worshipful Brother Robert Jackson and Frater O. If you'd like to contact Frater O, you can contact him via the email address on our website, or it should be in the show notes. If you'd like to contact Robert E. Jackson, I'll have his contact information there as well. But I hope you enjoyed that deeper level conversation on the number 7. And, you know, we can never get as deep as we want to get because time just does not permit, but believe me when I say that we had probably talked for 30 minutes before, and then we talked this hour-long conversation, and then, even after we got off, we continued to talk a little bit more. So there's always so much going on with symbolism and interpretation and the way this information gets passed from generation to generation to generation through what we call time immemorial. It was fantastic, and huge thanks goes out to those guys. Just one more time, we didn't get off the phone until about midnight, so it was amazing. But that's it for this week. So once again, please consider supporting the program. Go on over to wcypodcast.com. See how you can give a monthly contribution if you'd like to. We have 3 different levels there, whether you want to be a producer, a fellow, or a contributor. And we also have our lapel pins, or if you just want to donate $1, even that's great. All that goes right into the production of this show, takes care of our hosting, websites, all that good stuff. So thanks again. And I also would like to mention we do have another guest host coming up. I've got Brother Jack Aquilina from the Brought to Light podcast, which is the Southern Hemisphere's first Masonic podcast. It's a great podcast, which is dedicated to discussions and research papers about Australian Freemasonry and the Victorian jurisdiction in particular. It was founded on the 2nd of July 2016, and the podcast has become fundamentally important domestic and international voice for young Freemasons in Australia and overseas, where topics and news are tailored to the interests of young members in the craft. So I've got Brother Jack coming on the program, and keep an ear out, because I've got a couple of my friends right here in Illinois who brought the Blue Lounge Social Club to Illinois, and I think they're going to have some guest hosts on Brought to Light, so that'll be pretty amazing also. And I got a lot of great feedback from our last episode, which we had Brother Nick Johnson guest host. Huge thanks for that. So much positive feedback. Man, Nick brought the feels in that episode for sure, so many thanks goes out to Nick as well. And with that, we're going to wrap it up. So until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
Dorothy Mantooth is a saint.
Take your mother out to a nice seafood dinner and never call her back.
Milk was a bad choice.